Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Reardon.
And I'm Scott Horsley, sitting in for Ron Elving.
That's right. Ron is actually off the Somali coast. He just decided to just commandeer a boat. And I don't know, I guess when the ship hits the fan, he'll be back.
But, good luck with that.
But we do have Scott Horsley, White House correspondent. And the big news, I guess, this week, not the big news Brzezinski, but the big news is Barack Obama's return from what I would think is a pretty successful European / Iraqi visit.
Well, it really was the big news. We got some new data out from the Pew Research Center about how much of the news was devoted to that story over the last week. And it was like one in five stories in the newspaper, on TV. It was the most watched story and the most presented story of the week. And generally, I think, presented in a very positive light.
I know we're all in the tank for Barack Obama, but it's fair to say that it was a successful trip.
It was certainly successful in terms of the tone that the president set. It was not successful in the sense of getting a huge increase in stimulus spending by the countries of Europe.
It was not troops in Afghanistan.
Not successful in getting a huge number of new troops to Afghanistan. But the White House had done a pretty good job of lowering the bar on those things ahead of time. So there was no real expectation and no great disappointment when those things didn't come out, say the G20 or the NATO meeting. So the focus tended to be sort of more on style and the temperature. And on those things, I think he came out looking very good. We should say, you know, even though they had done a lot of work to lay the groundwork ahead of time and say, look, we're not expecting to come out of this with France reversing course and saying we're going to devote billions and billions to domestic stimulus, David Axelrod took time to, again, tamp down those expectations in the middle of the trip.
Why didn't the waters part, the sunshine, and all ills of the world disappear because President Obama came to Europe this week? That wasn't our expectation. That'll take at least a few weeks.
Some of the headlines, I guess, were the fact that Obama met with the Russian president to talk about reducing nuclear weapons. There was some kind of an outreach to Iran, saying that we'd like to talk to Iran.
You know, this was really a whirlwind. Jonathan Weissman summed it up in the Wall Street Journal. 19 one-on-one meetings with world leaders, six countries, 12,500 miles. I mean, a lot of ground was covered, both literally and figuratively. So we saw again the capacity of this president to pivot from one thing to another seamlessly, even when he's got a bad head cold.
I'm not a fan of polls, but the thing that struck me the most is that New York Times CBS poll that 39% of the American people felt more optimistic about the future. And while 39% is not a big number, of course, but it was 15% in January.
In early January,
and 7% in October. So that is obviously somewhere the new administration is making a difference.
Yeah, now the poll was actually, it came out at the beginning of this week. It was actually done, I think, really before the trip started in the very first few days of the trip. So I don't know how much the trip actually swayed opinions. But yeah, 66% overall approval rating for the president, a 59% approval of his handling of foreign policy, 56% approval of his handling of the economy. And that is such a big change, not only from where we were under the previous administration, but also over the way the Republican Party is viewed. Much less approval of them.
But you could have a great, you know, great trip and a great fanfare and all that, but there are still world problems. And one of them, of course, in the past week was the North Korean missile that passed over Japan. Fortunately, in time for Passover, so I thought the timing was excellent.
You know, it's interesting. Some people talked about that as stealing thunder from the president's nuclear nonproliferation speech. I kind of thought it underscored the nuclear nonproliferation speech. Obviously, it was an effort by the North Koreans to say, hey, look at us, pay attention to us, even if, according to the U.S. watchdogs, the missile launch was unsuccessful. But I think it actually gave more attention to the nonproliferation speech than it might have otherwise received.
And perhaps part of it is the fact that the leader of North Korea was obviously not feeling well, according to the headline. You saw that headline? Kim Jong-il. And I thought that was sad.
All right, so, you know, we had an election in North Korea.
We did.
and he was, again, confirmed as the leader.
But there are actually some elections in this country
that were a little more competitive.
A little bit. One that was not competitive was a new one in Illinois 5. That was the one where Rahm Emanuel left to become White House Chief of Staff.
That's right. And Quigley won. And this was kind of a new thing where the results of the election were announced on the same day that the voters went to the polls.
Right. Well, actually, a lot of people, I spoke to some people in Chicago, they were so displeased with the choices, they only voted once, which is unusual for Chicago. Obviously, there are some other elections that are still going on. Minnesota Senate is probably one of the big ones.
Are we in the second year of that count now?
We are in many weeks. November 4th was the election. Now, a three-judge panel, we keep talking about this every week, about this three-judge panel. Well, finally, they decided to count a bunch of, actually, it's like 351 ballots, far less than Norm Coleman, the former Republican incumbent, wanted.
And Al Franken actually widened his small lead.
From 225 votes to 312 votes.
So what is the end game here? When are we actually going to have a second senator to represent the people of Minnesota and to take the load off the lone senator who's doing the work of two now?
You're saying that Amy Klobuchar cannot do the work of two?
She is doing yeoman service, I know, and David Wellen has reported on all the extra work that's piled up on her desk just in terms of constituent service. But the people of Minnesota deserve the same representation everybody else except the people of Washington have.
Actually, a lot of Democrats felt that Norm Coleman was doing the work of three men, but unfortunately it was Curly, Larry, and Moe. We expect the three-judge panel to say, perhaps in the next couple of days, that lo and behold, Al Franken did win this election. Norm Coleman and his attorney, Ben Ginsburg, have argued that that still disenfranchises thousands of Minnesota voters because there were a lot of previously rejected absentee ballots that they want to get put back in. So they will almost automatically go to the state Supreme Court. If they don't get a favorable ruling there, there are folks like John Cornyn in Washington, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, who said, let's go to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, let's fight all the way. Obviously, in Washington, the feeling for Republicans is that they don't want a 59th Democratic seat in Minnesota.
Yeah. All of this is a bigger deal than it would be because the razor-thin difference to getting
to the filibuster-proof
majority
exactly.
For the Democrats.
Now, there's also pressure on Governor Tim Pawlenty, the Republican, who, of course, once the three-judge panel rules, you'd expect that he may be pressured to certify the result. But the last I heard from him is that he said, look, as long as Norm Coleman is still fighting this in the courts, there's no hurry for me to do anything.
If Coleman does appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court or even to the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, are we likely to see a resolution of this, say, before 2010?
There is anecdotal evidence suggesting that folks back home in Minnesota are a little tired of this, but Republicans are saying that, look, he's entitled to all this. There was only a 312-vote difference. But ultimately, I suspect that if the state Supreme Court turns him down, that could be the end of it. Again, Tim Pawlenty has a future as well. He's up for a third term next year. He's a possibility, a White House possibility for 2012.
Well, what's the better move for him? I suppose in the primary, maybe it's better to drag it out as long as you like, and then maybe for the general election, that might not work in his favor?
Yeah. Ultimately, I think, though, that if there was a backlash against Coleman and the Republicans, it's not only Pawlenty who has to face the voters. Even if he doesn't face the voters in 2010, other Republicans will. So my guess is that if Coleman loses the state Supreme Court, that could be the end of it.
Well, 300 and some votes in Minnesota, that's a landslide compared to what we're seeing in the New York 20.
Yeah, that's the one that Kirsten Gillibrand gave up to become a senator, and that's between, right now, Jim Todisco, the state assembly minority leader, has a 17-vote lead over Democrat Scott Murphy. That was the election that was held 2 weeks ago.
And that's 17 votes out of something like 150,000 cast.
Exactly.
Not a huge turnout for this special election.
Well, actually, it was an unusually large turnout because obviously so much was at stake. Whether really so much was at stake is just debatable. But, of course, both sides tried to make this a referendum on President Obama's economic stimulus package. But April 13th is the deadline where overseas absentee ballots are counted. And so I suspect, barring a court case, which we've become accustomed to, we could have a result by then.
If it goes one way or the other, who does get the bragging rights? I mean, can either side really say, for those who were calling this a referendum on the stimulus package and on the early leadership of President Obama, does either side get something to hang their hat on there?
I think they will, but the other side could always say the opposite. In other words, if Jim Todisco, the Republican, says, well, we won despite all this great hoo-ha about Barack Obama, the Democrats could say, well, look, there are 70,000 more Republicans in that district than Democrats, so of course the Republicans should win it.
Yeah.
And so
to win by 17 or even a few hundred is not much of a victory in a district as lopsided as that one.
Exactly. One thing.
How did Gillibrand ever win it?
Gillibrand wanted two things. She ran in 2006. She ran against a congressman named Sweeney. And Mr. Sweeney had problems. His wife accused him of beating her up, and they were hurt. He showed up at a frat party half drunk and uninvited, which was an embarrassment. And, of course, 2006 was also a big Democratic year anyway, nationally, because of Republican scandals and the war and things like that. So it was a perfect time for Gillibrand to run. And she maintained a pretty conservative record. The question is how far to the left she will move if she wants to win statewide for the Senate in 2010.
Well, courts have not just been counting absentee ballots. They've also been ruling on same-sex marriage in Iowa last week. And We've had legislative action on that front in Vermont and here in the District of Columbia.
Well, that's the big difference, because previously in the states that have had approval of same-sex marriage, which is Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Iowa, as you said, in Vermont, this was the state legislature that overrode Jim Douglas' veto, passed it. And so it's the legislature that put its political future and neck on the line by approving same-sex marriage.
Now, it's interesting. California, where I used to live, of course, the legislature had approved same-sex marriage in 2005 and again in 2007, both times overridden by Governor Schwarzenegger's veto. He said, we ought to let the courts decide this or let it go to a referendum.
And then it went, and then in California,
of course, it did go to
Prop 8.
Referendum, and, yeah.
One relationship that seems to be frayed is between Judge Emmett Sullivan and the Department of Justice.
This has got to be a story that I think must leave bitter feelings all around. I mean, no one, I think, can be particularly happy with the way this came out. If you were a Ted Stevens supporter, you feel like, okay, maybe he got railroaded in court, and even though the conviction was set aside, he sacrificed his Senate seat, and he got robbed at the ballot box. If, on the other hand, you are still convinced that Ted Stevens was a crook and lied on his disclosure forms,
right,
then you feel like, geez, he's sort of gotten off on a technicality, as it were.
But the point is that Sullivan, who doesn't seem to be frothing at the mouth usually, but he said in his 25 years on the bench, he never saw more prosecutorial misconduct than he did in this case.
Yeah, and I guess that's why we really do have to hold prosecutors to such a high standard. So when there are convictions, people can feel like they were worth something and not just motivated by politics.
Somebody said that Ted Stevens, for the first time in his life, smiled, which is kind of remarkable. Republicans in Virginia don't seem to be smiling lately.
No, they've had all kinds of hang-ups with their chairman and ultimately gave him the boot.
Jeffrey Frederick was the state chairman. Matter of fact, he defeated former Lieutenant Governor John Hager last year. The only reason I mentioned John Hager's name is that his son married former President Bush's daughter. But anyway, Jeffrey...
Were you invited, by the way?
My mail delivery is really
I've had that
off.
Same
yeah,
problem.
Bad times for the Republicans in Virginia anyway. They lost George Allen's Senate seat in 2006. In 2008, the Democrats won the presidential vote in Virginia for the first time since 1964. They lost John Warner's Senate seat. They lost three House seats. In addition to that, Frederick, the Republican chairman, in October compared Mr. Obama to Mr. Osama, saying that both had friends who bombed the Pentagon, a very polarizing figure.
Yeah, but now, wasn't Bill Ayers just a guy in Barack Obama's neighborhood?
Along with Mr. Rogers, right, just happened to. No, I mean, but again, it was a kind of comment that John McCain disavowed. It was just kind of controversy that the Republican Party didn't need.
Is this a sign that the Republicans are going to be getting back on their feet in Virginia, or is this just a sign of total chaos?
Well, it sounds like the latter. Bob McDonnell, who's the former state attorney general, who is the Republican nominee for governor, has also called, you know, wanted Frederick out. But Frederick said, one, that if you kick me out of the party, a lot of grassroots conservatives, social conservatives, are going to sit home in November when not only is the governorship up, but 100 seats, all 100 seats in the House of Delegates. And two, at the May 2nd state convention, Virginia state convention, Frederick says he's going to fight to win his chairmanship back, which could be more headaches when the Democrats are also not having an easy time of it either. Terry McAuliffe, Craig Deeds, and Brian Moran are three Democrats fighting in the June 9th primary, and that is getting a little personal too. But as long as the Republican Party seems to be self-destructing, whoever comes out of that June 9th Democratic primary could be in good shape.
But this Virginia debate is really kind of a microcosm of the GOP's challenge across the country, right? How do we define ourselves? Are we the party of the social conservatives, and do we want to play to that shrinking base, or do we want to redefine ourselves in some way that would give us broader appeal in other parts of the country, but runs the risk of alienating the people that brought us to the dance?
That's a big part of it, but of course, other people are saying that it's not about ideology. In fact, Tom Davis, the former moderate congressman, said that, look, Frederick did a good job. It wasn't a question about that. It's just that the polarizing things he said, it's not the ideology as much as it is about the temperament and his personality. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
Remember, you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Scott Horsley.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Ron Elving won't be back next week, but I do have some pirate jokes. How much are earrings for pirates? $1 each. They're a buccaneer. No, that's not funny. what that pirate movie, what was that rated? Oh, it was rated
R.
Yeah, okay.
For I am a pirate king. A pirate king. A And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king.
It is, hurrah for the pirate king!
Hurrah for the pirate!